And welcome to the Dice of Screaming podcast. Oh, sounds a little haggard over there. All right. Well, hey, I'm Randy.
I'm Mike.
And welcome to the Dice of Screaming podcast. The revolting peasants of gaming podcasts.
Sir, the peasants are revolting.
Well, of course they are. That's why they're peasants. They're revolting. Have you seen them? That's us, the revolting peasants. Yeah, so, hey, welcome. We're here a little late, but not forgotten. Just things getting hectic, but we got this podcast out in, well, not really.
And we're a couple of days off our game.
Yeah, we're not late, but we're not really late. Okay, well, we're almost really late. But, hey, we're here. And
the little gaming podcast that is never on time.
That's right. Fashionably late, that's what we like to say. So thanks for showing up, and hey, we got some topic to talk about. Let's launch right into a little bit of that. We were going to call this episode Whatever Happened to Gnomes and Drow, and turns out that we had a little bit of a mea culpa to issue right off the bat.
That was me getting over enthusiastic. I still have lingering frustration over the brief gap where gnomes were dropped along with half-orcs. And I was, conflating it with the current edition, which does in fact include those. Like, those are all back, in the fifth edition. We do not know what is going to happen to the sixth edition.
Oh, well, yeah, who does know what's going to happen?
Yeah, the next iteration. We're still in the dark about that. But there was a gap in 4th edition where, new character backgrounds emerged and old character backgrounds were getting dropped. And this has been, a shifting landscape almost continuously. So we're really talking more about that than we are about whatever happened to a specific thing. The drow have been subject to a lot of controversy. Some of it slightly justified. Okay. Yeah. I feel like there's meat on the bone there. There are things that are wrong with the way it was handled. Way to make it awkward and embarrassing, guys.
Yeah, true.
There were some misfires. But there are people who,
Well, I think it's a combination of misconceptions and pre-assumptions on both the fan community and how the obligations of making a remastered Paizo that's free of a game, a Pathfinder that is free of its legacy issues, like some of the races that we believe are important to a legacy version of an adjacent game like Dungeons & Dragons and Pathfinder became. That Pathfinder inherited a lot of things that people assumed that, hey, you're just basically making a new edition of a game that everybody loves and knows, and so you're just using a lot of those familiar races and faces to make a game that everybody is familiar with. But in turn, when they have to break away, they have to loosen themselves from those old shackles and ties to the new going forward, new edition.
I forgive this entirely in the case of Paizo right now. This is legal bulletproofing, okay? Yeah, because you've realized at this stage, many of the smaller publishers have realized that they are dealing with a very litigious outlet, okay? Potentially volatile legal environment where what you are publishing right now may be subject to legal scrutiny as IP, in the future.
Intellectual properties, so, yeah. You got to free yourself from those old legacy issues and move forward.
I want to just open with, I don't resent companies for bulletproofing themselves against legal assault. That is absolutely within their rights. I'm not mad at them for doing it. I am, however, frustrated personally by the situation. I don't like having to kiss favorite things goodbye, or frankly, what really happens, as the kimono flutters open here, what really happens is the DMs just have to do a little more homework to include material from past editions that they like and homebrew it into their game. Like, okay, structurally, this newest edition does not include these creatures, these classes, or these backgrounds. I have basically slapdashed my way into writing them back in accordance with the new rule system. But of course, this means that this is a homebrew game and not, you know, like played as written. So,
or more importantly,
I resent having to do it, but I'll do it.
But there's a wink and a nod to the idea that these are homebrewed additions, but they're no different than personal creations that a DM would insert from their own types of monsters or encounters that they would like to see played out in the game. So that's what we'll be talking about today. But hey, we got a couple of things to do.
Yeah, we got a little opener to go for.
Yeah, we got to talk about the next episode. So we have to discern what is in store for our future episode.
Summon the hoary bearded diviner known as the Astrogallomancer.
Indeed. Bring him forth.
He will lumber out. All right.
All right, there's the dice. Oh, they're in a
7 come 11. And he needs a new pair of shoes. Well, the Astrogallomancer's got problems. He's been down at the casino all weekend.
Oh. That's why it's so murky.
Don't worry. He's going to go get help with that. Like, there are groups. Okay, there are groups that he can see and work on this problem of his. So, in the meanwhile, what does he see other than looming dead? No. What the Astrogallomancer really sees is next week a glimmering into the nature of traps, hazards, and puzzles. Now, long ago, back into the misty reaches of time.
such a case.
We did an episode on traps specifically, and it was mostly about trap types, okay, the various types of traps that you could assault players with. And this was back in the earliest podcasts where we just covered them as, how shall I say it, one of the pitfalls. Oh, yeah, all right.
Yeah. Oh,
total giveaway.
Yeah.
But it's one of the things that was very predictably thrown at players in many, many, many published modules of the early age. And of course, the classical DM's Guide included it. However, we have an evolving landscape of possibilities that has been informed now by years of video gaming and some of the most creative writers and creators that we've ever seen. We've been lucky to live through this entire evolution of the concept. And it has really broadened the scope from like mere land-based obstacles that are, they're not traps themselves. They're not actual dangers. They are obstacles that like some thinking, some planning may be required to work your way past. And then of course there's the puzzles, which have widened in range of complexity from like the simpler things of yesteryear to some ludicrously complicated, perhaps far too much, but wow, what a shift in like over the decades. And a little examination of how, like, what shapes do those things take, and how are they managed at the table? So, yeah, it's less it's not a criticism. This one is a celebration of and a yay for. These are a DM's toolbook. I love them.
Yeah, it's been an evolving nature of the game, how it's played, from meticulously detailing how your character was examining for traps and pits and things like that, to hand-waving it away with a find, remove traps roll, and now how you interact and deal with these things has become a whole subset of rules and also procedures. So I think in a lot of ways, there's been a clapback to the old ways, like you have to specifically say what your character is doing, what they're looking for, but also relying on a lot of those things that we were talking about in the previous episode about adjudicating the mind, where there's just certain things that you have to let the dice rule them out or roll it out and then rule it from what those dice rolls indicate.
Yeah, there is a time and a place for both of these approaches. The engage the party aspect and the, okay, the dice shall let us know aspect. Knowing which times to use which approach is a little bit of an art form.
Yeah, and I think they've done a pretty good balancing act with some of the new rules that we've been looking at, both in old versions like OSE, which pretty much is just a reissue of older material, but and rules, along with a kind of new modern and much more engaging format, as well as talking about how these traps and things work. Do you really need to adjudicate how a player approaches a trap as much as their character is approaching the trap and is skilled in those ways? So we'll be dealing with that. So we'll leave that for the next episode. So we're here to talk about what happened to ... And as we started out, so we're going to get right into it.
Yeah.
We talked about, hey, you know, what's going to happen to gnomes and drow. So let's just start out right now that, as we alluded to right in the opener, that Paizo has just recently released that they will be leaving drow alone or on the cutting room floor, as the modern parlance says. It's that they're just not going to do anything with them. They're not removing them from the game, per se, excluding anybody from talking about them and further going forward. But they're not going to do anything with them as a company. They have to leave them on in behind because, well, legally, the drow, as presented, are a direct lineage to the original version of the game that has seen many arch iterations up, including to the current one and going into D&D 1. So as they move to the orc license away from the OGL, they completely have to divorce themselves from certain aspects that are deeply connected to Dungeons & Dragons lore. And the roots of the drow go way back. I mean, they don't go back as far as some, but they are right there. And so let's talk about, before we get into the drow, some of the races and monsters and opponents that we've had to kiss goodbye over the years.
Yeah, let's start all the way back at the beginning. Let's, you know, the original, you know, first dawn of the game, it was...
Beholders were on the cover of the Blackmoor. Was it Blackmoor?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How far that's already gone back. You know, that we're talking before... first edition, even, you know, like that's chainmail / Blackmoor era, little white books, 1974.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is how old some of this material goes. Yeah. And I do want to highlight that in the earliest editions.
Oh, that would be Greyhawk. Blackmoor is a completely different, my bad, Greyhawk.
Well, the point I wanted to make was that at the initial beginning of D&D, it was a period of constant expansion of opportunities, okay? From the pre-first edition era up to the release of first edition, everything between 1974 and 1981 was this constant outward expansion of, like, oh, here's a new thing you can be. Oh, here's a new thing you can be. Oh, here's a new thing you can be. And it became a little monotonous in that sense. But it was wonderful. People loved it. Like, wow, like, here's another different thing we can be. Not everybody liked everything, but everything was there for people to pick from. The continuing increase in number of options was, I think, part of the charm. Because it was a game of the imagination, and a lot of the people writing material and sending it to TSR for publication like expected no real reward for it. Like they did it, they published it in magazines and little, you know,
well, right,
things like that.
There were a lot of monsters, what's been called the plastic dinosaurs or the chinosaurs, I guess. I don't know how to really put it. That's what people call it. The original Greyhawk supplement had a fighter facing this weird creature with an orb with eyes and a mouth and several eye stalks. Looked like it was about ready to lay down a discourse about Fischalt and Chomsky.
Oh boy. So its power is to put you to sleep.
Yep.
No. That would have been one that decides to discuss Hegel.
Oh, yeah.
No, that's got head explodey power.
That's the mind flayer, the Hegelian nightmare.
Yes. Oh man, the mind flayer casts Hegelian dialectical. No!
My mind melts.
All right, inside philosophy jokes. Just, so I hope you'll forgive me for that. You know, this poor guy has to deal with this crap from me all the time.
Hegelian dialectics. Yes, let's discuss that.
Oh yeah,
never ever. All right, so
this will get us back to our origins with two listeners.
Yep.
Oh man,
that was us. So,
but the point was. We had this evolution outwards of increasing opportunities, handwritten by a wide variety of people and by staff at TSR, getting notions from written in from players all over the place. Like, dude, this would be a great idea. I would love to do this. Until we reach first edition's finished form at the final phasing out of the first edition, you had this. Wow. I mean, including Unearthed Arcana and other extant materials, just a ridiculously wide array of creatures and beings that you could play. Now, second edition, just to flash through it, I think everybody remembers us complaining bitterly about the removal of the class Assassin and the removal of demons. You know, Tanari and Batazu became our demons and devils. So it's not like the game has no history of editing. I mean, like literally, it was a path of increasing opportunities up to a point. And then with the second edition, we began the first era of editing to relieve social pressure. And in the third edition, we see the arrival of new things again with the Tiefling and Azamar. Which was great. I didn't hate those. I know there are some people who are furious over everything that is new. I am not really one of those people. Like I'm like, okay, that seems interesting. The thing that usually drives me nuts is having something taken off the table. That I'm like, stop taking stuff away. That is where the crusty grognard in me emerges. That exact specific thing is like a surefire way to draw Mike's ire. What do you mean I can't? Well, I'll do it without your permission. Ah!
Well, yeah, and that's the
little hint of the oppositional DM. Defiance there.
Yeah, and that's the agency of the DM. Is, you know, you are the arbiter of what is and what can exist in the game that you run. That said, you have to work
reality.
Pray I do not alter it further. The Greyhawk supplement, when it was first released, had Lizardmen, Beholders, Displacer Beasts, Blink Dogs, Mind Flayers, Carrion Crawlers, and all of the crazy stuff that we would begin to associate, like the Boule and some of the others, with the weird monsters of D&D. Like, what the heck was up with that? Turns out that they were based on a set of plastic dinosaur monsters that were like 75-cent pack. And yeah, you know, they just statted these things out, including the owlbear and things like that. Blink dogs, of course, maybe, you know, just dogs that do different things. Make them magical. The Displacer Beast from A. Van Gogh's, the Devourer? Yeah, I can't remember his original novel where the Displacer Beast was there. But yeah, probably somebody will correct us. I just wanted to touch on that. They pulled from a variety of sources, so not everything.
Again, I mean, that's a compliment, or it's a compliment to the nature of gamers themselves, okay? Like, all gamers are, deep down inside, there's a creative buried in every gamer. They may not think of themselves as DM material or creatives, but they are. Okay, they just may not have gotten in touch with that facet yet. But the innovation in terms of like being inspired by everything around them and then finding ways to work that into game material, that is the story of D&D. is how did we make this into that?
Evanco's science fiction short story, which was a Marvel comic, by the way, I
just found that out,
called The Black Destroyer, about an alien beast that could ship through walls and move around, displacing itself, and had a malign cunning intelligence, basically a precursor to the Alien movie. It was directly noted that that was an option for a while. But the Alien franchise went in a completely different direction with their Black Destroyer. But nonetheless, we've had a lot of creatures that are going to be going away in the Pathfinder remaster and have been gone for a while because of legal reasons. Wizards of the Coast around the early aughts set down a parameter of what was their intellectual property. And they defined very succinctly a lot of the creatures we just mentioned about beholders, displacer beasts, carrion crawlers, owlbears, and other such things. Although I think a lot of other game companies have been able to keep the owlbear in going because it's just, it's really hard to put an intellectual stamp on something that bizarre. It's an owl. That's a bear, but it's a bear. That's an owl. Okay. And that, and I think that for the most part, Wizards was pretty much turning a blind eye to getting overly judicious with that. But mind players.
There was a greater degree of openness earlier. And it's a shame that they have moved away from that stance and made it clear, you know, through their actions that while not taking any immediate action right now, there's a high risk for those who, you know, if you're drinking from the well, you got to be careful, you know. So I know it's an abundance of caution, but once a company has a fit like we had back in January, you know, a big overreach, it makes it clear that, like, at some point or another, that stuff was not written by accident. Okay, it's not like somebody just threw a bunch of Scrabble tiles onto a room and said, okay, assemble that, and, like, whatever it landed is going to be our new policy. These were long, careful, well thought out, you know, arrangements that they were hoping people would sign on to quietly and accept. And in terms of being a very large scale IP grab, obviously it didn't work out for them, and that is not the stance now. But we know that it was on the table. Like what the target goal long range was to have maximum IP control. Knowing that, any company in their right mind would take necessary precautions to protect themselves against future litigation, because it may not be today. It may not be 1, 2, or 5 years down the road, but in 10 or 20, very plausible. We have had the largest shift just in the last year of, you know, in the last 1 year of gaming, we've had the largest moment of change. And I felt like that was a thing worth noting, that it's not just Drow. Okay. It's a larger sphere of concerns as people playing various editions and various versions of D&D like games are, they're going to be at similar tables doing a very similar thing, and yet they will be playing with very different textbooks in terms of what creatures and concepts are available to them.
Well, the irony is this falls weird on me about how the early TSR basically took dwarf, elf, hobbit, and made that, okay, these are other things you can play besides humans. And now they had during that time, they had a legal kerfuffle with the Tolkien estate, and they had to change the names, so they couldn't be hobbits, they had to be halflings.
Yeah.
And certain creatures like race came into being rather than subtext, Nazgul or Treants were now, instead of being Ents, were Treants. They changed a few names and they moved on, and everybody was pretty happy. And D&D, as Mike has pointed out, like second edition has expanded its race of or choices. Well, you know, first we had half elves and half orcs in first edition, and the inclusion of gnomes. Then they padded that out to the, what was that, about seven races? Yeah, that was about six. Seven with humans.
And they started tacking in the sub-races.
Yep, we started to get Tieflings from Planescape, and of course, from Dark Sun, you had a few others. They didn't really catch on as fast, but they did linger on, especially the Half-Giant, or what we now commonly call the Goliath. And Dragonborn, Half-Dragons in 3rd Edition, you know, it's expanded, and it's went out from there. Genie-kin.
The Eberron brought us the War Forge, yep. Which, boy, was that a hit. I mean, all right, I'm going to...
Fantasy robot people.
Hey,
to sing.
If you liked Full Metal Alchemist and just want to be a suit of armor that kicks things in the ass, oh boy, have we got what you love.
Yeah.
So they pushed... I'm kidding. It's not the
right,
same.
Right. But you're not... Okay,
it's
you're
close.
Not, it's an archetype that hit well, and I think it was worth including. But
yeah.
We've seen that, like, that has become the core D&D experience. Now, along comes Pathfinder. They want to keep the 3rd edition alive, and they move forward. They accepted a lot of those creatures as legacy later. Wizards would kind of define what they could and couldn't use. But that was fine. Everything moved on, and everybody seemed to be happy. Now,
we still seemed to be on the curve towards more, in spite of the gnome hiccup, which I couldn't figure out. I mean, what on earth was the justification for, like... Well, we're making room for these new concepts. There weren't really that many new concepts. You feel like there was no reason to ditch gnomes in 4th edition. I think it was just a whole thing like somebody in brand proposal just said, well, we already got short people. Those are called halflings. Everybody loves halflings. They're established. We're going to keep those. Pitch the gnomes. And so the gnomes got punted, which...
Uh-huh. I see what... No, I'm just...
Yeah. Yeah.
Side eye. Yeah, I see what I already saw.
He sees, he saw what I did there. But
yeah, they got yeeted.
And I resented it. Okay. No matter how much I poke fun at gnomes, I still had a great time playing a few of them. So I also feel like they were a useful and.
Right. And they've evolved. They become their own thing. various games approach them.
Just not crin gnomes, or as I would refer to it as cringe gnomes.
Yeah, cringe gnomes.
And the cringe halfling, which is their kender. Yeah, the Dragonlance edition had some cringe moments. But yeah, other than that.
Yeah. As the games evolved, we've had a lot of new things come in. And it seems that, like, as other games that are D&D adjacent, and yes, Pathfinder is one of them, but now we're also looking at Tales of the Valiant from Kobold Press. That's going to be going forward. It's going to be interesting to see what they have there. They don't have no
Sword and Sorcery, which was the like 3E compatible.
Yeah, that was a whole thing from White Wolf Games. They were
cashing
in on the open D20 license.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of different D&D adjacent games that still required you to use the Player's Handbook, Dungeon Master's Guide, Monster Manual to get through. But then they began to say, well, you can't use certain monsters out of this. And that's where this whole thing really stems from. So, well, while we've well established that, we kind of want to leave behind some of the legalities. We will touch on it briefly in a moment here. But before we go into the break, I just want to give our listeners a little bit of idea of where we're going with this next part. Is so you can't officially use a monster in your setting. What's stopping you? As Mike put out there, you're, as a DM, the ultimate agent. If you want to include beholders and mind players in your Tales of the Valiant game, nothing is stopping you. For instance, you can rename them if you want, or you can just use the name because, well, officially, while Tales of the Valiant can't acknowledge them, you are not under any such strictures. And so that's kind of a non-issue for a lot of people. It's like, yeah, it's a nothing burger. I will just ignore it or use it as I see fit. And I think that is perfectly fine. And we'll discuss some of the ways that you can use that as a DM going forward. And also in clever ways that some of the publishers have sidestepped carefully around the use of these monsters by reskinning and renaming them. So we'll talk about that in next part, as we're going to take a brief break here, give your ears a rest, and we'll be right back. So stick around. All right, folks, and we're back. Thanks for joining us again. So yeah, let's refocus up. Let's talk about what really grinds your gears as a player DM about having to kiss some of these beloved deity core monsters and races goodbye.
And let's be truthful, we're not truly kissing them goodbye.
Right, right.
There is a specific brand of the game that you can get all of these things with.
Right, if you're a D&D gaming enthusiast, you're not going to lose that. If you're playing what we're talking about, specifically adjacent D&D games, that if you're moving away from WotC's core products,
now
you've got some problems, and you're going to have to make some adjustments. Now, me, I just basically say, well, screw that. There's always going to be carrying crawlers in my game, and there's always going to be a beholder. I might call it an eye tyrant or an eye fiend or whatever I need to call it to make it work, but players will fear it.
It will suck. For me, it's less a resentment of what's going to become unavailable than a resentment of the loss of innocence. And what I mean by that is that up until very, very recently, there was the more or less automatic assumption that we existed in a gamosphere with various corporations, and that there was a sense of at least, if not active cooperation, then at least a absence of hostility, like a mutual existence, a coexistence, a sense of sharing, just a sense that gamers were all moving in the same direction, swimming in the same waters.
Yeah, we're all in this together.
And it was not a dog-eat-dog, rat race, big fish eats the small fish kind of world. We didn't exist with a consistent knowledge that that was the environment, the corporate environment, that our hobby comes out of. And we lost that innocence in the last year. The realization that it is in many respects a 100% modernized marketplace of ideas and IP, and that there is a very ruthless aspect to the way in which these matters are handled.
Yeah.
So these things have not been banished. They have not been destroyed. But our innocence, our notion of fair play and equal give and take, and hey, share this, here's a great idea for this game, we use it over here at ours, but I think it'd work great at yours, that the ebb and flow that is normal for those of us at the table, we're kind of coming to the awareness that that doesn't exist at the corporate boardroom level. Like that.
Yeah,
that
is, there's not some underlying tensions that probably always existed that we weren't aware of.
Yeah.
There were probably some angry emails or letters or cease and desists that were shuffled back and forth. We're aware of a few of them. It happened a couple of times. But
they have not been the average on the curve.
Right, and we depend a lot on Wizards being a good steward. And I think for a lot of people, that illusion has now been shattered. That as Wizards, with Hasbro mostly at the helm, they've decided, for whatever reasons, better or for worse, to make their IP their brand. And going forward, it makes it hard to use that in other D&D adjacent games outside of the core D&D experience. Now, if you're playing D&D and you're like, hey, you tough toenails to the rest of you, this is just what D&D is, I'm trying to say that I hear you. Yeah, that's a good reason maybe to play 5th edition. But there's also another, or the new edition, D&D 1, or whatever they are going to end up calling it. Those are good arguments, but, if you want to have bind players, well, then you just got to, buckle down and bend the knee. Well, see, there you go. That's the whole problem, as Mike elucidated very succinctly. He's quite clear that there was kind of a wink and a nod that, you can't use bind players because the legal guys down at in the legal department said that we probably shouldn't let out something that is a core brand of the D&D experience, out so easily, but yeah, we're not really going to go after you. You know, we're just not going to. Well, that's all changed. And a lot of people feel a little upset about that. Now,
I'm one of them. You know, that sense of a gamosphere. As it has become more modern in nature, the gaming marketplace has been governed or been introduced to many of the practices that are in place in other retail and business and IP related industries.
Mm-hmm.
And many of those are alien to the gamosphere. Okay. That's, you know, we're looking at concepts that function very well, or I mean, maybe not in a not pleasantly,
like in the software industry or yeah, things like that.
Exactly. And people are looking for that Microsoft moment where, like, aha, we have conquered. You know, we are Google. Resistance is futile. Your uniqueness will be added to our own.
Hail our Google overlord.
Exactly. There's a Borg-esque collective mentality of, like, assimilate, grab hold of, and, like, then have absolute, total, you know, dominance of a marketplace. That's a very hungry thing in the corporate world, that perpetual appetite to continue to devour and move outwards and, like, dominate. Look, the weird thing about gaming is there was always one big fish and then a very large number of little fish. And if you roll the clock back to, you know, TSR at the dawn of this, they started off a small fish that somehow mysteriously struck it big just on the basis of
people's enthusiasm. Well, they were in a pond with other big fish, Avalon Hill.
Well, they were up against people who didn't do a thing like they did. Okay. They emerged out of tabletop miniatures gaming and offered something slightly different. And the slightly different thing took off like a shot. It outpaced rapidly the sales of the things that were their inspirations to begin with. At that point, many other little game groups started to publish. And because it was such a new environment, the competition level was not nearly as cutthroat. There was a group understanding that, like, hey, we're all pursuing people in a niche hobby. And it's really just a question of, like, who publishes what first. And as long as you're not stealing whole cloth, plagiarizing, like, I ripped the covers off of, like, their book, and then I put my cover on it, and I'm selling the same rule system.
No, well, Arguin
that
Grimoire,
you couldn't do, but
I would argue, would be a good example of that. They used a lot of different things in D&D, but much like Pathfinder, they were D&D adjacent. They used most of the rules, but they had things like Franks, Bolo tanks, crazy stuff like that.
Yeah.
They had ice folk. People made of pure ice. I mean, it was as diverse and crazy as you want. But the Franks were insect men, and if you read a lot of that stuff early on, you would understand the Thrykreen are almost exactly the Franks, what we would know as the Thrykreen insect people. The mantis hunters.
They really bug me.
Oh, yeah, they do. They're everybody bugs. But Arguin Grimoire,
I'm so sorry,
did get a couple angry letters from TSR's execs, but nothing really came of it. Most of the time, they backed off from where they got too much into. But I'm pretty sure that if you had Bolo tanks, then you would have beholders in there as well. So nobody, I mean, a mind flayer could be just as welcome in, or as welcome as mind flayer can be, but would be just as fitting in that setting of Arguin Grimoire's world as it would be in Greyhawk or the Forgotten Realm. So let's, as we establish this, there was kind of like a garage punk ethic back then. You know, everybody ripped off of each other at a certain level. As long as you understood that if you were borrowing, it's okay. But if you were directly stealing, and TSR did directly steal from other companies as well, they weren't perfect.
Yeah, in essence, like, there's a lot of cover bands, okay? But they're all doing their own version in live performance. And they all had the good grace. Like, dude, don't just tell people that you invented this. Just, you know, give us credit before you do this, all right? You know.
Palladium Fantasy.
Don't try to pass this off as purely your own. So, okay, today we're performing a favor to find from this band, so-and-so.
Tunnels and Trolls with leprechauns and
as opposed to being a garage band that goes, like, you may not realize this, but I wrote Anarchy in the UK. You'd think the Sex Pistols did it, but we did it first. Okay, at that point, you may be in some trouble.
Well, you know, there's an argument to say.
But that freeform environment has crashed. That is gone. That doesn't exist in this gamosphere now.
Yes, there's no Diogenes of gaming. And, oh, yeah, that's another philosophical one. Oh,
we're back to the philosophy.
Diogenes, man.
The ultimate cynic.
Is punk, what is Diogenes punk? No. Punk is Diogenes. But, yeah, there was this kind of cooperative effort. And as things got all corporate-y, yes, we do use that one a lot. Thank you, Frank Metzner. When things start to get corporate-y and the legal beagles start to get involved in, well, you have to make sure to protect your copyright because you don't want somebody stealing your hard work. Look, Gygax himself, when asked pointedly, I think it was about a couple years before his death, why he never published Greyhawk back in the day, the way he played it. He said that he had invested thousands of hours into the game, and he never thought he would ever get an appreciable return of that investment back. There was no financial reward for all that work that could be done at play because he wasn't doing it for money. He was doing it because he loved it.
Yeah, pure entertainment value.
Like, and I think that ethic died somewhere in the 80s. You could point maybe 81, 82 when they started to get like, oh, the AD&D brand is different than the D&D brand or whatever you want to point. Look, we can get off in the weeds on that one. But to keep us on track here, the monsters that made D&D D&D were worth Wizards of the Coast putting an IP brand on. That said, everybody's been able to put, and I've used it in Pathfinder many times, calling them Eye Tyrants, which is one of their sub-names from the original edition.
Well, and I'm not in a public forum or public setting, so like at a game table, I'll call it whatever I want.
Right, you can call it Beholder and make it work for you. But is there something wrong with...
There's much bleeding and squealing on the internet, but the truth is that like at the gaming table, like no one has power except the players and the DM.
Yep, okay, and that's what Wizards learned really hard. Hasbro Wizards learned really the hard way.
I didn't want to hit him with it like a slap, okay? Like, you know, this is the... I'm trying really hard to be a parent that teaches through example. But then when your kid is doing something so horrible, like, no, you do not get to light puppies on fire.
No.
Bad. Wrong. Never, ever do that. You know, just... too much laissez-faire leads to having a psycho kid that doesn't have boundaries. So we had to be horrible to our beloved company. We had to be mean. We had to be the disciplinarian for a moment and say, I don't think you understand the power dynamic here, which is that you really don't have any.
You don't get to tell us how to play, and we don't get to tell you how to run your company. Oh, but we do.
We do get to tell you how much we're willing to spend on your product. If you're actively hostile to us, like as long as that tantrum is going on, you're not getting any candy. So I hate to be that guy. I don't want to be in that position.
Well, yeah, you don't want
to. What I wanted to do with
my
day.
We're here for fun. But I want to point out that that's where we're at. And when you have to say like, okay, so you're going to call mind players at your table or illicit. You're not going to let anybody tell you what you can.
Oh, I continually use the term the Dark Elves, which, you know, I have done different spins on Dark Elves,
mm-hmm.
One of which was where you can't actually tell the visible difference between a Dark Elf and a Light Elf.
Yeah, that would be a token.
Yeah.
Share token. There were Dark Elves that fell sway to Sauron's persuasive arguments.
Yeah. I have
followed him into the dark lands of Mordor.
And I borrowed from Midsummer's Night Dream, and I created like two Fey courts, one of darkness, one of light. And the two Fey courts existed independent of one another after a great split between the two, with the principal difference in philosophy being that one believes in seclusion and distance from the mortal realms, and the other believes in total freedom to interfere in human affairs at will. And, you know, this was the big difference between the two. I've done other different spins on the concept of oppositional elves. And honestly, I still love the concept of the drow, like deep down, because it's the marvelous old Scandinavian mythos of creatures that dwell beneath
drow the earth. Drow is a subtext for troll, by the way.
Yeah.
As we found out this week.
You know, using dark magic to lure people to their doom.
Troll doesn't always mean a monstrous, regenerating, fire-hating creature. It often means a monstrous creature of malign intent and monstrous abilities.
Yeah, because although the popular language of today informs us that a troll is this, and it's mostly based on, like, Grimm's fairy tales, which is...
Billy Goat's Gruff.
Yeah. That is 90% of childhood awareness of the concept of a troll is, you know...
Or on the internet.
Grimm's fairy tale. Well, okay, yeah. Oh, God, it's greasy, fat, and hideous, and lives below the earth, using its mom's interwebs to spread its evil. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry.
No. It was totally a purposeful derailment for a moment.
But the Scandinavian, the actual meaning of it is actually pretty widespread.
Yes. Like
that there's a huge variety of things inside the category of the
they didn't think of a troll as just one thing. It meant a whole category of things like fairy.
Yeah, the fey or strange or otherworldly included, you know,
just like the word bear.
Elves.
No real word for bear.
White-haired, black-skinned.
Well, yeah, fame, malevolent. And if you strip off the misogyny and weird fetishism.
I am going to say that the origins of this stuff comes from a very innocent place, a very safe and reasonable place that I don't feel any offense at. But where it went in the 1980s makes my entire soul cringe. And the 90s were not especially good to it either. Okay. oh my gosh. Like so many good things, people managed to screw it up quite badly.
R.A. Salvatore did a good job of really spelling out the malevolent nature of the elves and how they look at each other. But he didn't really do anybody favors by leaning heavily into the matriarchal society. I mean, we all like the fact that, oh, they're topsy-turvy elves. Their skin is dark, and yet their souls are just even darker than their skin. And that they're beautiful but deadly, but, you know, wouldn't want to get captured by them because they'll do weird, kinky things to you. And, okay, you can stop right there, sir. Stop right there. We don't need to know. Yeah, imaginations are just fine as they are. Everybody imagine to themselves.
Let's not get too lurid here.
But that it became some weird, almost like, oh, they're feminazis. I mean, I've seen that at several tables. This is what happens when you let women in charge. Okay.
Yeah, way to make it weird and cringy, dude. I mean, projecting much.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sorry, what is it? If you're really that upset, we'll call in Helga, She-Wolf of the SS, to help you work this out in another room, you know. There are places for your fantasies. Yeah, for your deep-seated
issues.
This
isn't one of them.
This is not the place. This gaming table is not for that.
So. Yeah, so I get it that there was a weird topsy-turvy sort of thing, but there was also kind of this weird dynamic. But with that, you strip some of that away, and you go with the core concept. And I would say, what are the best hits of the drow? As I've outlined, I would make them more albinoid, although I wouldn't try to use an ableist term on that one. I don't want to traumatize anybody, because albinism is a whole thing. It is a genetic marker, and it is a birth category that doesn't necessarily place you in the best of conditions, but...
Well, not true albinism, but rather use cave albinism, which is
right,
a natural condition of creatures that dwell under the ground.
Which make them adverse to sunlight, which fits perfectly. And as Mike said, you can call them dark elves. I might even call them umbral elves. And if you wanted to also just to paint them purple, I'm fine with that too. Hey, who cares, right? Strange radiations under the earth have changed them. And
yeah, you can edit a core concept to your level of comfort.
Right, because, and if you want to remove some of the...
This goes back to one of our oldest mantras on this podcast. One of the oldest and most frequently stated things by me is that the power is yours. Does not... The accidental impression that you have had power taken away from you is a popular fiction of punditry. Okay, that, you know, you're being stolen from, you're being rendered powerless, this is being taken from you. No, it is you who has the power. You decide to have the power. Make the edits that you want. Is there a thing that you do not like about a facet of your game? You have both the right and the duty to change it. If there is something in it that you feel is lacking, you have the right and even the duty to add it. That is what it means to be a game master, to be a, you know, creative, to be a real engaged DM, is to make the adjustments that please you and your players, specifically your players. You know,
right, and kind of adding on to that, if you wanted to remove some of the aspects like the spider connotation, make it with centipedes and bats. Those are perfectly under natural underground creatures, and it would seem that
bat riding evil elves.
Yep, bat riding evil elves. And if you want to keep the sleep paralysis stuff, I suffered from sleep paralysis when I was a young boy, and it was from sleep apnea later diagnosed. But sleep paralysis is a whole thing. What if their venom was like that? You were slightly conscious but unable to move because it's a paralytic derived from centipede venom and psychotropic mushrooms harvested in their rare gardens.
Oh, great. You're paralyzed and tripping balls.
Yeah.
Which, oh, man, that reminds me of a weekend out on the East Coast many years ago.
So you just made these umbral elves, if you want to make them purple, or if you want to make them shadow elves, like I would, then I would make them more pallid and pale. But however you do it, you've just made drow yours, and you've not lost anything. Now, you want to go with the mind player, and you say, hey, let's instead have squid heads. What else is slimy and vicious? Well, they are, in a way, leeches, right? They are draining something or taking something from you. So make them leech-headed, and, you know, Ooh. Boy, you've got a whole new level of horror going on.
Yeah, because, honestly, if you want to do research on how to have a great creep factor in your game, study the Nature Channel.
Yeah.
I mean, especially the things that are not, like, traditional mammals. Like, you get into the like, insects and arthropods and, you know, like, all of that stuff. It starts getting weirder and creepier and grosser the more the lens, the camera closes up, it just becomes terrifying.
We'll put another notch for the philosophical joke. Naturalism studied. I was never concerned that naturalism is not, H.P. Lovecraft didn't half right that all nature is antithetical to human life and logical belief because we have the assassin bug that covers itself in the corpses of its desiccated victims. That's nature. It's
brutal. Nature's like honey badger. It don't give it.
Yeah. And that's
honey badger don't give it.
Well, it don't give enough. But the whole point is that you can make any of these creatures come alive. The carrion crawler, okay, so it slashes tentacles around and paralyzes you, then slowly devours you, just like the gelatinous cube. Yeah, those are a little bit more hard to say improve upon, but you can work on it. I'm pretty sure that you could make a carrion crawler adjacent creature that is just covered in writhing tentacles and undulating its way down a hallway, blind and sightless, but just with a gaping maw in its underbelly. That is it walks around blindly, just bumps into stuff, and then reacts by violently lashing out with its many tentacles. You could call it a rot lasher or whatever comes to mind. And the gelatinous cube, some things are cubes and some things are spheres. So think about that.
Yeah, but steal, recycle. You know, great DMs don't borrow, they steal. Again, another trope of this podcast itself, like just the thing that we've often reiterated. That power is your own.
All right. Well,
let's not underestimate yourselves. Is the gospel that I would preach to the gaming world is that the published material ebbs and flows. Your ability to make use of what concepts are already in existence or which you develop on your own is limitless. It is beyond the scope of anyone to control or change. So yeah, the common link in what's awesome in gaming is always you.
Right. And I guess we'll land the plane on that one.
That's my gospel.
Yeah. Don't let you have the ultimate power and no one can take it away from you as what you want to have and what you want to include and what you want to keep or even borrow. Make it yours. That's your power.
I know that the half-orc, because of the connotations of the, like their origin stories being, you know, so dark and so graphic, has fallen out of favor, and we're probably going to see a shift to having just orcs, much in the tradition of the, you know, very popular
World of Warcraft. Orcs are going to become
World of Warcraft, and I'm not really opposed because I think orcs are
awesome. If you still want half elves and half orcs, you can have versatile heritage, and yeah, it doesn't have to be dark.
Yeah. You don't have to make it awful, you know.
Also, on, like
Skyrim
the Nephilim.
Orcs are awesome.
Nephilim as the replacement or stand-in for Asmir Tieflings. And so, yes, your half-angel, half-demon, half-vampire player character is confirmed.
Yes.
It's my first player character. Oh, don't look. But they're here right now.
That is happening at some table. Or I'm sure it already has.
Yeah, it's a little internet joke. You know, it's a little comic strip where they're like, oh, don't look now, but my first D&D player character is here. Don't make eye contact. Who are they? Oh, it's a half angel, half devil, half vampire. Totally cringy. Oh yeah, it's so awkward when they come around. I know. It's my first character. I was trying too hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh man. Yeah, I remember your table for the late stages of third edition. Oh my god. Like the
my god.
The min-maxing. The min-maxing in play. You're like, my character is a half this, who's a half that, who's a half this, and like it's like also these three different classes to so that I can work my way to the specialty class that unlocks this specific power that allows me a feat that allows me to combine that feat with the three other feats before it that magnifies my damage to 6,000 points of damage per round. Psychos. I exaggerate for comedic effect, but it was not extremely distant from that. And this guy managed to ride herd on those people and make them work for it week after week. That is not easy. So, and I watched it happen. And even I sat back and went, damn, dude, I don't know how you do it. Because I would have like, rocks fall, you die. That would have been day two. I don't have that level of patience. You're a good man, Charlie Brown.
I have Clive Barker to thank. Really, his comics at the time really led me to delve into what truly can horrify players.
Good man. Yeah. All right, we all love Clive Barker.
Yeah. All right, so.
Yeah.
All right,
guys.
I think that landed the plane on that one nicely. Yeah, you have the power. Don't let anybody fool you. You include what you want. Nobody is taking it away from you. But yes, companies for legal reasons have to do things that maybe we don't really like. But they're not doing it to really screw you a lot of times. Even Wizards, what they're really doing is trying to do what every corporation does, is round up their brand and place it under one roof. And that's all they're really in the end doing. And
they're staking their claim for the long term. You know, they're playing the long game on this. And I can't technically fault them for it as a tactical move. But it's not generating goodwill.
No, it never does. And it's just an age that we are in. But all right. So that's going to do it for us. Until next week, I think we'll put a bow on this and call it done. So until then, may the dice always roll in your favor.
We're out.
See ya.